It's Monday, September 16th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Young people are feeling anxious about the growing threat of climate change.
I definitely at first just kind of wallowed in my own anxiety and was like, oh wow, so like there's nothing to do, like it's over.
I still have climate anxiety on a daily basis.
I have nightmares about like hurricanes.
And parents are struggling with their own fears about our planet's future.
I'm deeply concerned about the state of the climate, as are my children. As it may be, I would not encourage them to have children of their own.
Plus, a new documentary looks back at the career of iconic Puerto Rican actor Raul Julia. We'll hear from the film's director and Julia's friend and colleague, Edward James Olmos.
He was probably the foremost contemporary artist of Latino culture that had ever been able to grace the planet.
But first, climate anxiety and our kids. As our planet continues to warm and governments move slowly to address the threats of climate change, young people are feeling fear and anxiety over the planet's future.
I definitely at first just kind of wallowed in my own anxiety and was like, oh wow, so like there's nothing to do, like it's over. As someone who's young, who can't vote, who's still in school, you oftentimes feel helpless when it comes to things like this because you think that there's a limit onto what you can do.
That's Seema, a 16-year-old from New York City. And Seema's like a lot of kids who say they're stressed by the state of our planet. A recent poll from the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 57% of teenagers aged 13 to 17 say the issue of climate change makes them feel afraid.
As soon as you understand that every decision you make has a lasting consequence on everyone around you and there is no escape, it becomes like there's a legitimate mental strain with that.
I still have climate anxiety on a daily basis.
I have nightmares about like hurricanes. And why is that? That should not be a thing. So now we're getting to a point where people are scared beyond just reading the news, but actually within themselves.
Those were young people that organized Friday climate strikes in New York City, speaking with WNYC reporter Gwen Hogan. And while many kids are feeling anxious about global warming, they're also leading calls to action.
Sea levels are rising, and so are we. Sea levels are rising, and so are we.
We are unstoppable. A better world is possible. Stop denying the earth is dying. Stop denying the earth is dying.
These consequences will face us during our lifetime, and it is already happening now. And it will get worse. So I think that is why so many young people especially care about this.
That's Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teen activist speaking on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Greta's been a driving force behind a global youth movement for action against climate change. And she'll be leading more protests this week in New York City ahead of the United Nations Climate Action Summit. And all this week, we'll be covering stories of climate change as part of a collaboration with 250 other media organizations called Covering Climate Now. As young people grapple with the realities of climate change, parents are faced with decisions ranging from how to talk about climate change with their kids to whether to have children at all.
Hi, my name is Taylor Michael from Tarzana, California. Climate change has affected my decision to become a parent. At 26, I'm seriously thinking about if I want to bring a child into this world with such a grim future ahead of them. I'd much rather adopt a child that's already here and teach them to be a responsible adult who cares about the earth.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Oakland, California. I chose not to have children because of climate change, and I made that decision decades ago. I worked with a lot of scientists, and I understood the problem very early on.
Hi, this is Mike from Portsmouth. Originally, I was very hesitant to have children, but it was important to my wife. As it stands, I'm deeply concerned about the state of the climate, as are my children. As it may be, I would not encourage them to have children of their own.
And some of you also told us the climate is impacting how you parent.
Hi, this is Leslie from Los Angeles, and I still plan to be a parent, but climate change has definitely affected my decision to go about it in a way that's minimalist and ecological.
My name is Elizabeth Ackerman from Los Angeles. Personally, I worry a lot about the world my kids will live in. I train them some basics of survival without electricity and plumbing. I use sustainable practices, and I teach them that we must all look out for and help each other.
Thanks for weighing in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Let's open this up now to two experts on parenting and climate change. John Fraser is a conservation psychologist and president and CEO of Knowledgy, and he's also the editor of Springer Nature's Psychology and Our Planet series. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you for having me.
And Megan Kalman is the co-founder of Conceivable Future, an organization that helps bring people together to talk about how the threat of climate change impacts the decision to have children and how we raise our children. She's also an assistant professor at the School for Global Inclusion and Social Development at UMass Boston. Megan, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So, John, let's start with you. We just heard a lot of young people that are talking about their anxiety around the around climate. How is that related to the stress that their parents might be feeling?
There's a pretty direct connection between parents' sense of anxiety or fear and how their children are responding to it. Children translate what they hear from the adult world around them, but they're doing it in very simple ways. So they are not able to weigh the strength of the problem. And that causes a great deal of anxiety.
And what do we know about, John, about how climate anxiety actually shows up in adults? Like, what does it look like?
It often manifests in how people present themselves. You can see elevated anger, concern. Just stress behaviors are very common. So, you know, just fighting about basic things, being upset. We see at the extreme level when people are in grocery stores, they find themselves a little short of breath because they're looking around at all of the single-use plastic, all of the chemicals that are being produced, all of the toxics that are around us. And quite honestly, it starts to make them anxious. And so they may behave in ways which are not as, they're stuck in this place of just not knowing how to deal with all that stuff coming at the same time.
But John, aren't parents really good at hiding their emotions from their kids?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. I know of no parent who can hide their emotions from kids.
Mm-hmm. Megan, you've talked to parents about how climate change is impacting their parenting. What are they saying to you?
Well, I think there's sort of a range of fears that parents or would-be parents face that we've seen in our work, right? On one end of the spectrum is this bundle of concerns about how my child's life is going to affect the fate of the planet, right? Everything from enough diapers to circle the earth to carbon footprints to, you know, the amount of plastic that it takes to get somebody through first grade. And on the other end of the spectrum is a set of concerns about how a hotter, meaner, more volatile, less stable world is going to affect the futures of those children or those would-be children. And then everything in between. So parents and would-be parents, and I think one of the things that's really worth pointing out is that in our work, the same fears apply to parents and people who are considering parenthood, that the world is going to be less stable in significant ways, and everybody's trying to figure out how to be responsible, loving, parents in that context, and then also to push for the kinds of systemic changes that we need so this isn't a reality that confronts generation after generation after generation.
Now, we know birth rates, Megan, in the United States are already low, but when we think about more and more people choosing not to have kids at all because of climate change, what effect is that going to have overall as we move forward?
Well, one thing I would point out is that even without the threat of climate change, the United States has as close to an antinatal policy as you could get without actually calling it an antinatalist policy, right? We don't have universal health care. We don't have child care, medical, strangers beg strangers for money to pay their medical bills on the internet, right? We have food deserts. We have this, we have that. So I think what we're seeing is a confluence of lots of kinds of crises that are exacerbated by the climate crisis, right? So birth rates are dropping, but that's not entirely due to climate change. The climate change figures quite heavily into it, according to a recent poll from Business Insider. A third of Americans of childbearing age consider climate in considering their decision whether or not to have children. But what we stress is the interconnectedness of all of these issues. If for instance, the medical system and sort of the social safety nets that that generations of Americans have relied on up until now were in better shape, we might have people feeling differently about their ability to cope with the impending crisis.
John, we know that we just talked a little bit about how parents' behavior can impact how their kids feel about climate change, but there are other sources of information that kids are getting, particularly today, online, in social media, yeah, in school, in the media itself. I mean, how important are those sources to kids feeling anxiety?
Well, they're all primary sources for a child. So what they're hearing at school, what they're seeing on the internet, these things can't be hidden anymore. Parents can try to cloister their children, but they are getting these three sources. The parent is the primary referent for the child. School is the second. And then the internet and what their friends are saying, sharing with on their smartphones, becomes a third source. All of those places are setting the context. So when there's contradiction, they may be a little bit more confused, but they're still getting a lot of information from all over. And it's really their parents that are guiding them through that information.
And Don, when we talk about concerns that really that fall into two categories here, worrying about contributing to the problem by having kids at all, or worrying about what your own children will face if you bring them into this world, what do you think about those concerns?
I think they're real. I think it's quite reasonable to be anxious about the state of the climate. This is really no different than what parents went through when we were experiencing plague, when we've been experiencing war. I mean, catastrophic events have affected people over generations, and people tend not to have children during wartime. Go figure. It's fairly mm-hmm. reasonable to make those decisions. A negative birth rate is actually going to be positive for our response to the climate issue. So I don't think that deciding to have children or not is necessarily grounded in the it's not the worst thing to do, because there are still going to be children in this world that we can bring up. And I think we heard that in one of the earlier conversations that someone's choosing to adopt. So negative birth rate's still a decent solution, because especially in the Western developed world, we are still, even with a child, no matter how sustainably we live, we are part of a system that relies on a lot of carbon-producing products.
Megan, we heard from a couple listeners that they are choosing adoption instead of having their own children. And here on the show, we've talked about how adoption can play out differently for different kinds of people, whether they're women of color, low-income women. I'm wondering, what demographic breakdown are you hearing from when you're talking to folks, Megan? Are there gender or racial differences when it comes to how people are processing these issues?
Yes, there very much are. I mean, the folks that we talk to are primarily well-educated. They are primarily, though not exclusively, white. And they are primarily, though not exclusively, linked into some sort of organizing already. And I will say that there's some pretty interesting, so with those caveats, there's some pretty interesting breakdowns, particularly as regards gender. So one of the things that we have found is that women tend to experience a lot more pressure to parent relative to men. And that, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a sort of a long history of socialization. There's sort of these cultural tendencies towards, you know, revering the figure of mother, et cetera. You know, and also a lot of it, frankly, is sexism, right? Is that we tend to consider men whole people whether or not they decide to parent. But the same cannot be true of said of women. And so women are called all sorts of names if they choose not to have children. And they're pressured, lovingly and otherwise, by members of their family, by media, by sort of public characterizations. And so this is another place where the realities of the climate crisis run into other realities that exist in our world, right? The ways that, for instance, women and men are treated differently. And I have a comment about the adoption issue, too, which is that, you know, it's not a silver bullet, right? We have to take a serious look at the systems and the structures that cause so many children to need other homes in the first place. Holding up this idea of everybody adopting begs the question of who exactly we're all adopting, right? And where those children are coming from, whose children they were. You have to also be considering the factors that lead so many children to need new homes, right? Whether those factors are addiction, whether they are institutionalized racism, whether they are poverty, whether they are natural disasters. Those are problems that we need to solve. And so to sort of put forward adoption as this, you know, fix really, really requires that we take a hard look at who these kids are that we think that we're adopting, right? It's not a straightforward issue, is my point.
And I want to give John a second to weigh in. I mean, I know, John, that we've on this show, we've talked extensively about adoption and who gets to do it, who doesn't get to do it, who's sort of left out of the process. It tends to favor couples. It tends to favor heterosexual couples.
And those folks with money. But you wanted to make a point on adoption.
Well, actually, I didn't want to make a point on adoption. I want to make the point of adults being parents, no matter whether they adopt children, have children, are kinship families, or however you interact with children. The climate crisis is really something that we need to manage in terms of our parenting skills. Parenting is not does not require me to have a child. It doesn't require me to adopt a child. It means when I interact as an adult and think about the climate crisis, it's important to help a child process that information. So I agree there are systems at play that lead to privilege, lead to kids needing different kinds of love in their life because they weren't raised that way, or the systemic exclusion of entire classes of people. That's a problem. But that is not related to the climate crisis. That is a social safety net issue in the United States that does not affect other countries. The climate crisis is a global problem, and parents are dealing with it, or adults are dealing with it around the world. And so I think that's where we need to focus our attention.
Let's talk a little bit also about some solutions here, John, because we talked briefly in the first segment about there are generational patterns that we see where birth rates are affected by things that are happening in the world, like war, for example, the plague you mentioned. I mean, there's always something to be afraid of, right? Children are from different generations have dealt with this. So what are some solutions for anxiety on the part of parents and on the part of kids? What do we know about how we can ease their anxiety?
First, it's talking about it reasonably, not making it complicated, not making it seem out of control. What children are reacting to is their sense of safety, their sense of security. They need a sense of security and stability. But if you think about the pre-arming that parents did in the Jim Crow South when their children were facing discrimination, threats to their lives, and abuse, these parents, many of the good stories are parents talking about how to manage your care, be aware of what's going on around you, be able to be participant in the solution, and to think about what you do as a collective or as a group. Kids focus on teams when they're in that very sort of philosophically pure phase in that 6 to 10-year-old age. And it's great if we have a chance to talk to them about what our team is doing for good. So whether that was talking about participating in civil rights, whether that was talking about anything that might reduce war, or quite simply how we protect one another, those become the conversations that help a child process the threat without necessarily saying it's wrong or going away. And it's perfectly reasonable to say it stresses you out too as an adult.
Megan, let's talk about what you tell parents who come to groups and say, I'm just so stressed. I'm worried it's going to impact my kid. I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently about resilience. Aren't kids more resilient than we expect them to be? John's saying no, but Megan, I'm curious. What do you think?
I think our mandate is to, as John says, I really agree with this idea of talking about the collective process of making the world a world that we want to live in, right? We don't tell parents anything. We create a space in which parents and non-parents alike can come and bring their fears and their hopes and their concerns and their strategies and share them. And the idea is that in the process of coming together, exactly as he's suggesting, that we are able to make meaning for ourselves, that we are able to sort of give political voice to this sort of ambient sense of uncertainty and concern that everybody feels. And that process of meaning making, I think, is the most important part of what we do. We don't tell anybody to do or not to do anything. We create a space in which people can share strategies with each other and also just affirm that this is a really scary time to be alive. I mean, part of what has happened in the news media over the last 20 years around climate change is that, this consistent campaign of misinformation has made people feel crazy for having these concerns. And the thing that we most frequently hear in our community meetings is parents and non-parents alike arriving and saying, gosh, I thought I was the only one feeling this way. And so we really stress the collective effect of like bringing people together so that they're not the only one to feel this way. And they have the solutions. We don't have all the solutions, right? People have the solutions in the groups. So we just try to create a group where the collective wisdom can really sort of come to fruition.
Megan Coleman is the co-founder of Conceivable Future. And John Fraser is a conservation psychologist and president and CEO of Knowledgy. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, my name is Trevor. I'm calling from Atrisco, New Mexico. I am 32-year-old male and do not have any children. I paid cash for a vasectomy about a year ago. In addition to the deep concerns I have about the health of the environment and the effect on natural resources for future generations, I am very concerned about the decline of mental health resulting from the crisis.
28 years ago, I became a parent, and at that time, I thought one was enough because we were already overpopulated. I taught my daughter about the world, about where we are, and her feeling now is, how can I bring a defenseless little being into this screwed up world? So I guess I'll never be a grandparent, which is sad, but at the same time, it's scary to think of what the world's going to be like and what a grandchild would have to go through.
And thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on this. Keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we'll continue to bring you climate coverage this week in advance of the UN Climate Summit happening a week from now.
I would like to be here. I would like to be there. I would like to be everywhere at once. I know that's a contradiction in terms, and it's a problem. Especially when my body's clearing 40 as my mind is nearing 10.
In the 1980s and early 90s, the late actor Raul Julia was at the height of his career, acting on Broadway in musicals including Nine and Man of La Mancha, and movies like Kiss of the Spider-Woman and The Addams Family. At the time, the San Juan-born actor was just one of a small group of Latino stars thriving in Hollywood and on Broadway, and he always made sure that audiences knew about his Puerto Rican roots.
I love being representing Puerto Rico whenever I can. I think it's important that we break many of the stereotypes that people have about Puerto Ricans. Yeah. And I love being like a goodwill ambassador for Puerto Rico.
That was Julia speaking on PBS in 1992. 2 years later, at the age of 54, he died after suffering a stroke. Filmmaker Ben De Jesus was still in high school when Julia died, but the actor left a major impression on him.
Myself, as a young Puerto Rican trying to one day make it on Broadway, I had somebody to idolize, somebody to look up to, and there weren't many Puerto Ricans for me to look up to. And after he passed away is when I really dug into his story and understood this guy wasn't just a movie actor, he wasn't just a theater actor, he really excelled at all of them.
Now, De Jesus is the director of a new documentary from PBS, Raul Julia, The World's a Stage. The film traces Julia's career from Puerto Rico to New York and features interviews with members of the actor's family, as well as other Latino artists who cross paths with Julia. Actor Edward James Olmos worked with Julia on one of his last films, 1994's The Burning Season. But the two first met in the late 1970s.
He was probably the foremost contemporary artist of Latino culture that had ever been able to grace the planet. There was no one quite like Raul when it came to the understanding of his craft and also the understanding of his commitment to society as a whole.
I spoke with Ben De Jesus and Edward James Olmos about Julia's legacy, and Olmos started off by explaining what roles were available to Latino actors when Julia was first getting his start in the 1960s.
There was opportunity for any strong actor, period, whatever culture you were coming from. The difficulty was in the storytelling, the stories that were being told. There was no stories being told about Latino culture or seen through the point of view of the Latino ever. I mean, even today, it's really strange how vacant and how we are not represented in the art form at all. I mean, we're less than 4% of the images that we see on motion picture television and in theater. And when you start to realize that we're more than 20% of the population, it's very difficult to take. And Raul really understood it. And he never, I mean, I'd never seen anybody drive so hard with his culture at his side. I did it too, and that's why we bonded so much. I mean, we never stopped being who we were and where we came from. And we hit very strong and very high levels of our artistry and could have easily not taken the hyphen, Latino actor, and just became an actor, you know. So we started telling the stories. The last story that we told, Burning Season, where Raul played Chico Mendez and I played his partner, and it was the last really dramatic piece of work that he did. He was very sick. But to this dying breath, he was Puerto Rican, 1,000% true.
And to that point, Edward, Raul never tried to hide either his Puerto Rican identity, his Puerto Rican accent. We have a clip of him acting opposite the great Meryl Streep in a 1978 production of Taming of the Shrew. Let's take a listen.
'Twas told me you were rough and coy and sullen, and now I find report a very liar, for thou art pleasant, gainsome, passing courteous, but slow in speech,
yes,
yet sweet as springtime flowers. Thou canst not frown, thou canst not look askance, nor bite the lip as angry wenches will, nor hast thou pleasure to be cross in talk. But thou with mildness entertains thy words, with gentle conference, soft and affable.
That was Raoul in truly one of the most extraordinary performances.
When you hear that, Edward, a Puerto Rican actor doing Shakespeare and not necessarily Shakespearean English, was that something you think audiences understood at the time?
Of course. I got to tell you, he was not afraid of understanding that he could do it in whatever. He could do an English accent. Are you kidding me? He could do it in a second. He used to do it all the time. He'd make fun of it. And then he'd turn around and he'd say, but I don't want to do that. I want to do this. And then he'd do his normal voice, his true voice, the voice that was given to him by way of the roots that he had as a human being. And man, it resonated so pure. It became what Joe Papp wanted it to be, which was a strong commitment to allowing people to be. And to be the strongest that they can be is to let them be who they are.
I want to ask Ben, I want to bring you back in here and talk a little bit more about Raoul and Broadway. One of the things he did was perform some of these classic plays in communities that didn't have access to Broadway or even off-Broadway productions. And this was at a time when bringing theater to low-income communities was critical. But why do you think it was so important for him?
I feel like he connected with the theater and the classics in a way that was not necessarily typical of a young Puerto Rican in San Juan. And I probably, without being able to speak for him, I think that probably resonated with him, which is why not bring it to the kids in Harlem? Why not bring it to the kids in the Bronx? You know, you never know. There may be some kid over there who it resonates with. And even if they don't become an actor or go in that path, they've been enriched by the art that they've been exposed to. And even now, the public theater still continues to do the mobile theater, and it's a really huge part of keeping the dialogue and the beauty that art brings to society present, not just to the people who can afford Broadway tickets, but to everybody. And I think theater is for everyone. It's not meant for the elites. It's not meant for a certain level of society. It's for everyone. So I think that probably connected with Raoul's philosophy of his humanity and bringing art to everyone.
I want to talk about the bankability, because Broadway is also a big business, as we all know. And Raoul gave one of his most iconic performances in the Broadway premiere of the musical Nine.
Being just me is so easy to be when I'm only with you. Open inside and with nothing to hide from your view.
But before that premiere, the producers in Paramount backed out of the production because they didn't think Raoul was bankable enough. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, yes. I mean, back then, there was probably a certain level of stars that they thought the more traditional, kind of bankable stars on Broadway that could be on the marquee. And it's common knowledge, but it was Barry Diller who was running Paramount at the time, who, thought, well, Raoul is not a big enough name and he hasn't even done musicals, which unfortunately was, there was due to ignorance because he had already done Three Penny Opera. He had already done Two Gentlemen of Verona, which even before, Hamilton and all these kind of like forward thinking versions of Shakespeare or classical theater, that was what Raoul was a part of. So I just feel like it still exists today where for whatever reason, it seems like the Latin side of talent, especially with Americans in particular, that we just don't get the same credibility or the same shot. And in particular, the Latin History for Morons that John Leguizamo was doing, which I happen to be one of the producers of that show. And we actually had to deal with the same exact issues that Raoul probably faced in Nine, which is, well, why do people want to hear about Latin history? And why do they want to have this Latino telling them their stories on Broadway? That's not going to work. And in reality, we ended up being the first Broadway play that season to make our money back. So again, if we listen to what society tells us, then nothing gets done. So I think in many ways, that's what I'm trying to do with the stories that I'm telling And with the stories that John is telling, we're not going to take no for an answer. And a lot of that comes from what Raul did, which was he just didn't take no for an answer. If somebody thought, well, this role in Presumed Innocent, it's Sandy Wexler, it's got to be a white guy, Raul said, well, no, I think I can do it. So I think that philosophy is something that we need to keep alive, which is we can't take no for an answer. We just need to do it ourselves.
And Edward, off of that point, I mean, first of all, Ben, I will say I've seen Latin History for Morons, and the theater was packed when I saw it. So take that for what it's worth. Edward, the idea that Latinos are not bankable, particularly when it comes to Hollywood, when it comes to television, and particularly when we're not playing a lot of the stereotypical roles like a maid or a narcotraficante or something like that. Do you still see that happening today?
Oh, yeah. Our stories are still not there. Name me one Latino hero that's won a Congressional Medal of Honor that you've seen the story of portrayed by a Latino in the United States of America in film, television, or anything. You can't. There's been no really strong understanding of what we've contributed. So that's why we will go down in history as people who definitely understood the situation. But I don't know if we're going to really be able to make a conscious difference in our lifetime.
Ben, I want to get your thoughts on a little bit of how you think the creative landscape about Latino stories, Latino actors, Latino creatives in the country is going to change based off of what Edward was just talking about. We are in a very unique moment for the community right now. And do you see that as creating more opportunity?
Well, I believe that our stories are more important than ever, because in many ways, the art and entertainment, it's not just disposable. It's nothing that is something that is so fluffy. In reality, art and entertainment is almost like a mirror to society. And if we don't see our face in that mirror, and if other people don't see us in that perspective, then they kind of fill in the blanks and decide what we are or what we're not capable of or what we are capable of. And I feel like more than ever, using our stories to kind of change the landscape of the perception of Latinos in society in America is more important than ever. So that's my personal commitment. My personal commitment is to move the needle, even if it's in a small way with John's show, Latin History for Morons, or in the stories that we've been telling with the documentaries. We need that, because if we don't change the way people perceive us, if we don't highlight the richness of our culture, then they decide what we are based on their own perceptions or their own limited knowledge of who we are. So I'm personally committed to doing that, but it's a little disheartening, because like they'll have a Roma come out and they'll say, but we gave you that, and the Mexican directors keep winning the Oscars for best director, but that's not who I am. I grew up in the U.S. I grew up on the East Coast. I'm 100% Puerto Rican, and I'm 100% American. So that part of the entertainment culture is where we really are lacking. Because, like I said, there's this little kind of community who I love. I love the community of Mexican filmmakers and Spanish filmmakers who've been really able to have a lot of critical success. But even still, the stories that come from the barrio of New York City, that come from Washington Heights, that come from Miami, that come from the Chicano neighborhoods of L.A., those, for whatever reason, we still haven't had our moments. So I'm personally committed to changing it in any way that I can. But if we don't do that, then the perception will kind of exist. We'll still be kind of pigeonholed into this limited version of who we really are.
Ben de Jesus is the director of Raul Julia, The World's a Stage. And Edward James Olmos is an Emmy-winning actor and was a friend of Raul Julia's. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.